Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for joining me and listening wherever you may be around the world. And today, I'm doing another author interview with YA fantasy author, Jinlyn Frontin. She is the author of the Yarstar trilogy, the book one being The Unmarked Girl, a story that I read literally in a day, which is something I'd never do, I promise to everyone. And it's also an award winner for the BERT Award for Caribbean YA Literature. So, Jinlyn, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you so much for having me, Blaze.
it's a pleasure. I remember when you reached out to me for your novel, Yarstar Trilogy, The Unmarked Girl, I was immediately drawn by the cover, and then I didn't know how fast and quickly I would be drawn up into the world. It's just how amazing of a book it is for me personally. So why don't we start from the beginning? Tell us a little bit about your childhood in terms of like reading and literature and how you got to become an author today. And what made you want to become an author?
So childhood, I would say, was a little strange as to why I would get into sci-fi fantasy, because I grew up in a pretty religious household, and it was a very stringent way of approaching the world. So things that were a little too out there were cautiously dealt with, so that we didn't have much exposure to that. My books growing up reading were more in the Nancy Drew and the classics and so on, nothing really in this genre. But I found myself constantly dreaming in fantasy as a little girl, even though I had no exposure to it in any huge way in my real life. And then I think around the time that I became a teenager or a preteen is when we got a cable package, because I'm, you know, in a Caribbean island, a cable came to us a little late in the game. And that's when I got the sci-fi channel. And it was my first time actually seeing things that I might have dreamt or things that I would think of in my own imagination, just kind of displayed on that. And then my brother and I would sneak to watch certain movies and series like Highlander, for example, of Duncan MacLeod, of the Clan MacLeod, and all the way to La Femme Nikita. And so that I found that I got my taste of things that were different more from watching TV shows than I would have from the things that I was reading. Until I was about, I think at this point, 12 years old, going on 13, and my school decided to do The Chrysalids as its literature book. And it was my first fantasy read. And I knew in that moment that fantasy, like beyond a shadow of a doubt, sci-fi fantasy, I should say, would be my favorite genres for life. It was just arresting. It felt like I had found a language and worlds within it that I didn't know yet how to express. And somebody finally showed me that there was a path forward to expressing this. But at the same time, I thought maybe one day I would write little stories or create concepts, but I don't think I had any plans of being a sci-fi fantasy author of any kind until 2016, when the appearance of Yara, I don't quite know how to put it, because it wasn't so much sitting down and having an idea. It's almost like I was going through a situation in my life, trying to navigate the disparities between light and darkness in each of us as human beings, and what I was experiencing in exes and in friends and everything else. And suddenly it was like I had this story, and it was just a before and after moment of Yara just being there, and almost felt like a compulsion to have to tell this story from this person who navigated the, you know, the treacherous path between what is light and what is darkness within all of us. And that's how the story came to be.
Thank you for sharing. And you're right, Yara, she does tread that line of what's light and what's darkness, but you also do it like the light, the good and the evil. You also do it in the actual physical, with the actual light and the actual dark. And we'll dive into that part of the story when we go. So you said Yara came to you just spur of the moment, like you knew you had to tell the story.
Yeah.
So what is your writing process? Did everything just come to you and you had to just write it down as it came to you? Or did you have like some pieces in the background that like in terms of like world building that you had to write down? Like tell us a little bit about that. Like are you a plotter or a pantser?
So it's a bit of both, I would say, because I have no experience writing novels at all at this point in time. And from 2016 to I think about March 2018, I would have spent time learning a lot of things because I also wanted to learn how to publish the book as well, right? So that it was everything from reading up on how do people write novels and how do they write fiction and what is their approach to it. And there were so many different methods online and different people's recommended different things. And it was difficult to find my path through that because I know that everyone has their unique path they eventually find, which tends to combine bits and pieces of, you know, what they've learned and maybe something unique that they've discovered for themselves. And then within it, I decided, okay, my approach is going to be to write a synopsis. Right. And I would do chapter summaries. And I feel like if I do that, maybe I would be able to just ensure the story arc is fine and, you know, take a look at it from a developmental point of view and make sure that I was developing my characters and my story arc and the whole thing in a way that made sense. But then as I started to write that, I just kept writing, fleshing out more and more within these chapter summaries until it ended up being thousands upon thousands. I think it was probably under 20,000 words of a synopsis, which makes no sense, right? Because I just kept seeing scenes in my mind that I didn't want to forget. And I would just keep doing that. So eventually I pulled the plug on myself coming down to the end of March. And I told myself, okay, that's it. We are not writing a single line in a synopsis again. We're going to commit to writing the story. And that's when I focused on getting the first five chapters down, because I had, of course, the rest of it sort of built out in terms of I knew where it was going all the way to the end of book three, actually. I already knew where it was going. But I needed to commit. And I think working on those first five chapters repeatedly, my husband was my pseudo-developmental editor, even though you know, neither of us had experience in this, but his brain is just brilliant to be able to understand these things and to understand when things are pacing too quickly and moving too slowly and all of it. And he was my main critique that I welcomed and sometimes hated getting the criticism, but welcomed fully because I knew I needed to, you know, iron sharpens iron. And I think through that process, once I got those five chapters down in terms of my style, my flow, how to approach it, that was it. Like everything else was just flowing from there. So I just wrote out the rest of the book based on what I kind of had in the summary. Yeah.
Well, your husband definitely knows what he's doing. The first five chapters just flew by. YA is not a typical subgenre that I read, but what grabs me from a book is one, love the characters, and Yara is fantastic. Just from her story, learning about her past or what she knows and what doesn't know about her past. The side characters are fantastic. The pacing, which you are relentless. It's breakneck speed like most of the time. And that just gripped me. That's how I was able to finish it so quickly. Yeah. And the world building. What you do in just the first book in terms of the world building is something that is very, very special. Like I've read a whole bunch of adult books and they don't even touch what you touch in like this first book. So give yourself a big pat on the back. I absolutely loved it.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. So why don't we dive into this? So the first book in the Yara Star trilogy, The Unmarked Girl, is of course about a girl named Yara. And she is special in the fact that she is unmarked. Everyone in this world has some type of markings on them. They don't know what they are, where they came from. That's just known about the world.
Yeah.
And there's two tribes. There's the Foktak tribe, and then there's the Skotak tribe. And Yara, we'll get into the discussion.
Yeah,
So writing that first scene when Yara she's hearing voices, and some of them are like of what she sees other people she hears other people talking about, but there's this voice in her head that keeps saying, "Yara Star, do you know who you are?" And that plays consistently throughout the book until the end, where you get a little bit of understanding, but not too much.
Yeah.
So tell us about how you wanted this book to be set up and what you wanted the reader to see going into like the first five chapters and what you wanted them to feel.
So I think that 16, even from a psychological place, is the time in our lives when identity comes into question. And we enter the story when Yara is 16. I didn't think I would write a YA fantasy just to begin with, because that seemed odd to me. But I think there was something that even I needed to go back within myself and understand about what happens at that age for each of us and for myself that allows us to either just kind of go off course completely, you know, because we're out searching and we begin to feel like the things that we may have grown up knowing or the things that we feel like we never got answers for are worth that search. So we want to kind of explore all of our lives and we begin to rebel and we begin to do all the things that kind of lead us there. And then there's the other part of us that longs beyond anything else in this world to just belong, to find our people, to whether you might be in school or it might be within your own family that you don't, it might feel like an outsider, whatever it might be, there is both this need to break out and find out who you are while needing to belong. And those two forces can come up really hard against each other, because belonging sometimes means compromising who you are if you're staying in the place that you think you should belong. But at the same time, finding who you are can be so lonely, and it means that you may have to give up a sense of belonging from where you are right now in life. And I think that is the first five chapters intends to set the scene and to speak to each of us about that part of, do we really know who we are? You know, this is like when you think about it, all of us have this sort of relationship with the world that we were born into. If you're a pure sci-fi fantasy person, it might be why you also love sci-fi fantasy, because you question everything. You look up in the night sky and you see these stars and you have to wonder, and it drives you a little mad. Where did we come from as humans? What is even happening in this world? What is our purpose for being here? And I feel like her story is an analogy of what it is to go on that exploration and what it is to feel upended in the exploration by some sort of voice within us that keeps asking that question. Do you know who you are? Is this who you really are? Are you really here to do this? What is your purpose? And it just eggs at us little by little over the years until we probably pay attention, or maybe we don't. But if you don't, there's a restlessness that you just never seem to get rid of within you, of there just must be something more. And that for me was what, if anything psychologically, is what I wanted to set the first five chapters to be, but not to make it into a nonfiction overload of that, if that makes sense. It was meant to just kind of be in a beautiful fictional capsule of an exploration that she represented when she appeared into my life. So, yeah.
Thank you for sharing. That's a great way to look at it, and for Yara. And just a little bit more background for the listeners, so we didn't quite go into that. So Yara is found as a baby. No one knows who her parents are, what happened to her, but she's found by Lana, who and her husband, who are both members of the Fotak tribe. Now, two things about these tribes. The Fotak, oh no, wait, that's the world building. I get to get back. I'll get into the world building part of it, and then we'll go into the tribes.
Yeah.
She's found by the tribe, and she's raised. And we meet her when she's 16 years old, and she's training for her trials with Christos, who's the son of the chief. Yeah. And then as she's going through it and she does the trials, I'm not going to get into exactly what happens, but there's a big revelation. Mm-hmm. The chiefs, she's always an outsider because the people of the Fotak don't trust her, because they think that she is a Skotad, who's the other tribe, a spy, because she doesn't have any markings, but mm-hmm. she can exist in the sunlight, which the Skotad tribe cannot do. Mm-hmm. So it's a constant back and forth of, yeah. Is she, isn't she? She's just herself. She doesn't know anything. She's oblivious to what's going on around her, at least at the senior chief level and the world history. And it just completely flows and just captures you. I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop reading like every single chapter, like one more chapter, all the way up throughout the rest of the day. So I guess with that, why don't we talk about the two tribes that we set up? So we have the Fotak tribe, who are inhabitants of the sun, and then the Skotad, who are members of the shadow. They cannot live in the sun, but they have great night vision. So tell us about those two tribes, and maybe a little, we'll talk about the world building part of it right after that.
So the Fotaks are, in a sense, seen as honored by Sunstar, which is their god, and of course the sun, so that it's both a play on those, but there's something really spiritual and religious about them. It's a very exclusive tribe. They believe they're the chosen ones. They truly have that relationship with Sunstar in that they can dwell in Sunstar's rays and they cannot be harmed. And as well, we'll go into the Wilbillon after, as you said, but their ability to do that is how they view Sunstar's blessing on their lives. So the Skotads and the Fortaks have been at war for generations upon generations because the greens exist, which is this luscious, dark, covered, overgrown area that the Skotads can go into because it's shadowy enough and it's dark enough. But within the greens, for both Fortaks and Skotads, there's an abundance of food, an abundance of water, like there are things that they need there so that they end up having these clashes within that particular area. And there's a lot of fight for territory. There's a lot of fight for who gets to be in there and how do we survive? And all of it kind of is contingent on this gray area called the greens that, you know, both of them tend to intersect. And because the Skotads are seen as being of darkness, Yara also being found in that same darkness in the greens without any markings, there's no other, and she doesn't look like either Skotad or Fortak. You know, she has this blue hair and iridescent eyes and zero markings, which are practically like DNA upon their skins. You know, so there's nothing to tell who she belongs to, where she comes from. All they know as Fortaks is this girl is not one of us. They don't look, you know, she doesn't look like she's one of the Skotads, but what if she could be a weapon? What if they designed some sort of plant and put it there so that she could grow up as a spy among us? And what you find is that the Fortaks are very, they don't trust. They are very private people when it comes to giving that type of trust, minus a few characters in between who tend to perceive who someone is or the goodness within someone. And they believe that Yara must be good, even as a baby. So Lana and Soren taking her in, the chief allowing this to happen, everybody else stood against it, all of the elders of the tribe, but they were able to say, you know, this is a baby. We know that we don't understand what's happening, but it's a baby. Let's keep this baby and raise her and let's see what happens. So while there is that level of distrust within the tribe, there's also there's hope that represented in these few individuals that perhaps they can rise above these sort of divisions that they've had between the tribes and, you know, maybe explore a little bit more of their, I can't say humanity because they're not humans, but their alienness, beingness, those traits that belong to all of us as well, their openness to others, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head. You said like they're not humans, they're like they have this alien type presence, which leads right directly into the world building and what you do. So the planet that they are on, named Mira.
Mira, yes.
This is not in the spoiler territory. It's said pretty early. So, but it's actually attacked by a outside celestial weapon, which stops the Earth, not the Earth, Mira, from rotating. So it's stuck in place.
Yes.
Hence why we've been talking about the world is half light, which is where the Fortaks inhabit. And then we have half darkness, which is where the Skotad inhabit. Mm-hmm. So you're doing this great blend of science fiction and fantasy, and you're doing it flawlessly into the script. And I live for stories like this. Is this something you always wanted to do, is just blending these two types of genres into one? Because I remember years ago, I just saw Dune Part 2. So it's science fiction, but it has fantasy elements. And
yes.
Now yours is fantasy, but it has science fiction elements.
Yeah.
I just love talking about this. Could you just give me your two cents on how you feel about these two blendings and how you wanted to incorporate this into your work?
Yeah, so I am a science and tech geek, just to begin with. You know, I'm actually an engineer in my degree. I'm actually going to do my PhD in AI and engineering this year, so that I am very huge on sci-tech in general. And then, of course, science fiction carries it to a whole other level of what I guess anyone within this field would dream of doing, which is to bring new technology or explore things that have never been explored before, from the different types of energy forms all the way across to the different ways that technology can interact with us as people and can help our lives get better, just all of it. So I don't think I can ever write fantasy that's devoid of science fiction, because there is an attachment that I have to technology and the way that it works, and the way that maybe perhaps different, you know, galaxies out there might use it, you know, if there exists such a thing. And I can't see them being apart, because a society in general tends to follow that technological path of progression that you would find. And then, but in the book one of the trilogy, we don't get too much. All you know that is that there is some sort of celestial weapon. It did attack the planet. We don't get too much context as to what that is just yet, or why that happened, or anything like that, because book one is really focusing on where we're at right now in this world. But there is no version, I guess, of this story that will feel like — there are some people that are able to do pure fantasy, and that's amazing, and it carries you on a whole journey by itself. But I feel like the addition of the technological elements adds this sort of rugged realness to it as well, that just brings it purely out of potentially magical sort of realms into something that also feels possible. And I don't know why, like, it grounds it for me. As much as it's still science fiction, it gives it a little bit of grounding. So thinking about, okay, yes, scientifically, the concept of a planet that has been attacked and no longer rotates is very difficult to wrap your mind around, because what then happens? How does gravity work? All of those different things, so that it's worth exploring what sort of mechanism would actually keep it going still and not cause everything to all fall apart. And but within that process as well, there's the fact that now the sun, as the planet rotates around the sun itself, even though it's not rotating on its own axis, will only hit one side of the planet as a result. So that means only one side of the planet has light, but also only one side of the planet has sustenance. Because in order for things to thrive and survive and the greens to grow, it has to be in the light. So as much as the Skotads can't be in it, they have to come into at least the greens to survive. So that a lot of the world building is around what it takes to survive between those who are of darkness and those who are of light, and those places that we coexist, I guess, as humans, even in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah, that was fantastic to read. And it really got me thinking. It was like, what? It's like, wow, you throw this bombshell like very early in the book, and then you're picking up the pieces from, okay, wait, one tribe's in the light, one tribe's in the dark. There's this like greens area where they go into, but the Fotet can't see in the night. So it's always there, but they have, like you said in the book, they have leeries, they have ropes to like keep them tethered so they don't go too far.
Yeah.
On top of that, you have for each tribe their own history on like what they believe happened, who was in the wrong, and how this war started. Yeah. The folks, I believe, the Skotad were thought to be of the chosen ones, and that they needed to do away with them. When you find out later, through one of your characters, Toler, we'll love to talk about him, how they view what really happened in the Fotag. So you're playing with history and how it's told. And is it true that what one said versus the other? Probably not. It's probably a blend of the two, or maybe neither has it completely right. And then as we learn this, it just builds and builds and builds on the story itself until the ending, which we'll talk off screen about what. I know that was a lot, but can you tell a little bit about — you wanted to get a point of view from the Skotad, and our introduction is through Toler. Tell us a little about Toler and how she does come into contact with Yara, but that'll be a little bit of spoiler. So tell me a little about Toler.
So Toler is also the son of a chief. He is a great guy, very different to all that I guess Yara's been exposed to, that anyone has been exposed to really up until the point that he appears in the book. And he's our first interaction with what a Skotad could be. And, you know, a part of it is understanding as well that not every Skotad and not every Fotak is bad. You know, they all have their histories and they're working based on all that they know and all that they've been told. But Toler is able to bring a kindness and a sort of openness to understanding that, okay, you might see the world a particular way and you've been told a particular story, but there are two sides to this. And I think you need to hear our side. So that he is very diplomatic as a person. He is also very curious, way more open, I would say, Scotad seemed to be than, of course, Fotax at all, in terms of their understanding of life and understanding of things. And Tola, I think, needed to represent what she had longed for a very long time to feel when it comes to just someone being open enough without judgment. You know, and I think that was a representation, again, of all that we need in our lives as well. Just that one person who just is not judging you based on your appearance, judging you based on where you came from, judging you based on all those things, but is really interested in the truth and wants to fight for the truth, wants to defend the truth, wants to care for the truth at a particular level. So Tola is a really beautiful, one of my favorite characters, as actually he has been for her, even based on all the things that you, as you would know, having read the book, that he was able to do or the things that he risked. He is a really special, a special guy, to say the least. Yeah.
Yeah. Tola was, apart from Yara, he was my favorite character. Yeah. What he went through, his family, his history, what he risked in the story. It was very compelling.
Yeah.
Forward to reading more about him when I get to the sequel books. Yeah. With all this being said, like the popularity of this, of your trilogy is, has been fantastic. And actually it won an award. So what are other fans of your story saying about it? It's like, it's just so captivating. Is it something that just couldn't put down? Like, what's the general consensus on when people finish The Unmarked Girl?
So funny enough, my proudest claim to fame in a sense is what you said, that people, well, firstly, aside from it's of course natural, massive YA reading, I get a lot of adults who don't read YA, who have never read fiction, and who aren't generally interested even in fantasy. And they're the ones who read it out in a day. It's like almost every time. So that my biggest claim to fame has been, you may not like fiction, you may not like fantasy, but you might like this story. You may not like even YA, but maybe give it a chance and see, because that has been, I think, the most endearing part for me, has been seeing people relate to Yara's story, maybe in a way that it speaks to them or their inner child or their past teenage self, but also probably from the point of view that, again, it's a consistent call we have in all of our lives. Do you know who you are? Will always torment us. Do you know why you came here? Do you know where we came from? It's all the questions will always be there. And I think she is a nice capsule to swallow those questions in and explore them. Yeah.
Yep, that sums it up perfectly. Yeah. If every single adult reader who tries this and loves it reads it in a day, I think you've done a pretty good job. It's just that, just that captivating.
Yeah.
Well, we've talked about The Unmarked Girl, the Yaroslav trilogy, but you do have another work called The Order of Jael, which is an adult sci-fi fantasy genre. Yes. I have not read this. It's on my TBR. I will get to it very, very soon. But tell us a little bit about this, your thought process of writing it, and because I know you wrote a little bit about how the process of making this was different than the other ones.
Yes. So I decided... I would say The Order of Jael is very different to the Yaroslav trilogy, because yes, it is a new adult at a minimum, because there are a little bit of scenes within there that, you know, will definitely need to be from an adult moving forward. But I had a dream about the first chapter of that book. Like it came in a dream, and I woke up from it and said, wow, I really want to write this. I have no idea. So unlike Yara, I had no idea where it was going to go. And I decided to do an experiment. And my experiment was that I will not do a plot at all. Yeah, I'm not going to do it. All I'm going to do is write a chapter a week and release it without knowing where it's going to go next. And I'm going to tape it. I'm like going to have it out with all of its voice acting and all of it. I'm going to read it out. And the next week I'm going to go down again and see where this story goes. And I'm just going to allow myself the utter uncertainty and fear of what it is to write from that perspective and just see what happens. Now, that was crazy. It was, to this day, I am mortified by it because I think a part of me feels even scared to promote it as much, because in my head, I'm like, yes, I've had people read it and they're like, oh my God, like I didn't expect this. This was amazing. And I've never read a book like this that ended this way. And, you know, certain characters being who they were in the end and all of it. So I get that. But then there's this part of me that feels like I'm so attached because I wrote all three of the Arstar trilogy in a particular format. And this was my next fantasy thereafter. Now, I would say that that is the part that scares me. So I'm actually excited for you to read it. I'm excited for your honest review. Above all else, you know, with the understanding that it's going to be, of course, different. Yeah, it's a different story. But yeah, I would love to know how it flows for you whenever you do get a chance to get into it.
Oh, I can't wait to get into it. What is it? I don't think we talked about the plot. What it's about.
So the Order of Jael is, again, so world building is definitely a thing that I'm really into. I guess as you could tell from the Unmarked Girl. So the Order of Jael is also a split world. Existence, but this time it's sky and earth colonies that exist, and we have a similar, in a way, contention that takes place between these particular colonies. But it's a little different. It's a little more sci-fi. It's a little more war-based, and it is definitely more based on religion. So the Order of Jael. Jael is their goddess within this entire world. It's a new earth world, so that it's not different to earth. The people who are there are humans. And they came across in a particular portal at some point in time in the history of the earth itself. And the portal would have closed, and they've been there ever since. So that they developed sort of technology between them. And there were these spheres that existed on this planet that seemed to have voices within them. And one of which had connections to what seemed to be the goddess of this entire universe, who would have probably opened this portal to begin with. So this goddess exists within, as in the voice can be heard through this sphere, and it's like a massive sphere that exists within the city center. But only certain people can hear the voice that comes from this sphere. So as a result, they began to be seen as the priests and priestesses of this sphere itself and of this goddess Jael, because, you know, they're the only ones who could communicate with her. And they could obviously then relay, what does this goddess want, and what should we be doing here, and, you know, how do we get back, and what is happening, and, you know, hundreds of years have passed since then. Now, the other side of it, however, is the technology. So the other people who have a lot of power and who are the royals there are the technologists, because they were the ones who were able to tinker with the sphere, because the sphere is actually a sort of machine. They're able to go into it. They're able to do lots of things. And the order, which is the priests and priestesses, can't seem to exist without the technologists, even though it kills them. And the technologists can't hear the order of Jael, the voice that they hear. So they also have this dependency, so that now it's a kind of strange tension between those who are spiritual and those who are technological and what they want in this particular world. And then aside from that, you have the fact that it's those who are based in the sky and those who are based in the earth below, because the technologists were able to build something that carried, you know, the elite people higher up and left the ones in the ground below, so that you have all these layers of that. And then a commoner of lowly origins who married up to a guy within like the god of the place, she can suddenly hear the voice coming from the sphere. So we begin with her. Her name is Jada. And she knows that if she ever claims that, because hundreds of years have passed, that is considered treason and you will be killed. And there's no explanation as to why she can hear this voice like the priests and priestesses can, and we have no understanding of it. And she's kind of stuck in this world with a lot of politics between, you know, the technologists, royals, and the priests who are spiritual, and everyone has an agenda. So it's a very, it's an intriguing... It's an intriguing world. It was something else. So it's a lot more sci-fi inside of there, I would say, compared to before.
Well, I definitely can't wait to get to it. And my head's already spinning. I'm like, I think I know what might be going on, but we'll talk off screen about that.
Yeah.
I'm curious if that's correct or not. That's wonderful.
No worries. Yeah.
So this has been fantastic. I actually have a question, because I don't really have any people on who are based in the Caribbean. Are there any other Caribbean authors like yourself who you would recommend telling to other readers and sharing? Because I'm very curious because I don't really read too much Caribbean novelists.
So I would say when it comes to fantasy, there aren't too many of us, I would say, because Caribbean tends to treat with more, if it's something fantasy-like, it's more folklore. So it would be based on Caribbean characters we have here. And that would actually be interesting for you to probably take a look at in terms of culturally how those types of stories play out, which are very different. And then we have a lot of, well, we have it across genres, but I would say sci-fi fantasy writers isn't huge, but we do have people like a guy called Mikael Kahn and a girl called Verena Siblal, and they just all have kind of, Mikael has done a pretty large amount of work actually within that area, among other things as well. He's definitely a sci-fi, more sci-fi thing than fantasy, but both author. He would be somebody that might be interested to get you all to chat a little bit if you're interested, and maybe have him send a work across to you as well. But it is a thriving writing community, so that there's a lot of things. Like my award would have actually come from Bocas Lit Fest, which is in Trinidad. They do a lot of regional awards for writers, and they have like annual prizes and so on. And they've really poured a lot into the craft and into authors here, so that while my book isn't Caribbean based, it is more based on the fact that I am from the Caribbean, so that this particular award, it was actually the last year for this award, so they don't have a YA award currently yet, because until they have another sponsor for that particular award. But the Codebert award is actually from Canada, so they have Codebert would be doing things across there, and they have it for a lot of probably a few Commonwealth countries as well. But yes, there is a thriving market of writers, amazing writers, and we will find a few pretty incredible sci-fi fantasy writers here as well.
Yep, that sounds fantastic. We'll be sure to chat off about some of these authors as well. And just one final question. Are there any, apart from Caribbean authors, are there any other works that you've read over the course of your life that you absolutely love and you just want to scream and want to get out into the world of books that are like under the radar and just need more of a like following? Are there any works like that or any authors?
I'm bringing up my Kindle right now to tell you. So, I mean, I would say I read a mix, right? My latest was actually, here we go, because it's so many. I'm all into fiction and nonfiction, so that you can just imagine what my Kindle looks like with its thousands. But there was one in particular, Babel, that I read recently. One of my friends, I don't know if you know it, it's by
R.F. Kang?
Kwan. Yes. Yeah, Kwan. Kwan, yep. Is that how you say her name? Yeah. That was my latest read. Insane. I mean, of course, there's a lot of accolades for it, but because it is a New York Times bestseller, I believe. But that book it took me months to finish it because I was doing it in between doing some studies for my PhD. And it was like my go-to when I finally got a break and wanted to relax, even though it's such a long and deeply intertwined theory of what it means to have different languages and the translations between them and the power that existed from that in silver working back in what would be historical, I guess, London, Oxford in particular. That was a mind-blowing read for me. Not so much under the radar, I would say, if I'm being really honest, but it was incredible. Good. Yeah. And the one I think right before that, hold on, I'm just going through tons of my other my other ones that are all nonfiction, because I've had a binge of nonfiction in the past year. Neal Stephenson's, it's the one about the sort of, it's almost like an AI world that he built, actually. A young lady's primer. A young lady's primer. And I can't remember, it's the longer name is that. I'm going to look it up. Yeah, right now. A Young Lady's Illustrated Primer was the long name. The Diamond Age. That's the shorter name. Oh, okay. So the Diamond Age, A Young Lady's Illustrated Primer. That one was the one that I read before it. So when we talk about world building, and it's interesting to bring up these authors, my style, as you can tell, is pretty punchy, right? I get into it. My pace tends to be pretty breakneck. I don't really have too much slowness happening throughout. It's always either character building within it or will building within it, but it tends to all be very intertwined. But these books were interesting to me because they're extremely long, for one, and the time that these authors spend building their worlds slowly, so it's like a lot of slow burns that take place within them, was such an interesting contrast, because I tend to read faster fantasies. So that those have been my latest two reads when it comes to that. In terms of underground authors, I'll probably have to get that to you, because I can't say offhand who is underground that I've read recently. You could probably recommend some people to me.
Yeah, I definitely. Yeah, we'll have a chat about that afterwards.
Yes, but, yeah.
This has been a fantastic interview. I thank you again so much for coming on. Could you tell our audience one last thing, where they can find you, your website, your social media handles, all that?
Yes. So everything is at Janelle Frontin, at Janelle Frontin. JanelleFrontin.com would be the website. And on Amazon, once you search my name and The Unmarked Girl, The Outside Trilogy, or even just my name alone, you'll get my books. There are five of them. One is nonfiction. The rest are all fantasy, sci-fi fantasy, in a sense. So that they're all available there. And feel free, if you've read it, drop me a message. Let me know how you feel about it. I'm happy to talk about it and answer any burning questions you might have, especially by the end of the trilogy, when I have a lot of people coming to say, okay, you need to tell me this, or you need to tell me that. So that I'm really open to sharing more in any way that doesn't, you know, reveal the plots too much, so that other readers can enjoy. And yeah, you can find me in any of those places. Just feel free to reach out. I'm open.
Awesome. Be sure to pick up the Unmarked Girl, book one of the Yarstar trilogy. I promise you, it'll be really quick, it'll be really fun, and it will hit you in all the right spots. I promise you that. So thank you so much for joining me, and let's do this again when we finish the trilogy and get to the Order of Jaiyalas.
Absolutely. Would look forward to it.
Cheers, everyone.